You have certain beliefs about the world, and those beliefs govern all the information that you get and how you interpret it and then how you behave out of it. Okay? So here's what we need to know. Everyone in here has a worldview, and everyone you come in contact with has a worldview. And what we're going to see is Jesus is going to interact with these people who have a different worldview than him, especially when we get to the Sadducees. They have a different worldview, and we're going to see Jesus, he's going to interact with these different people. And here's what I want us to be at the end of this. I want us to be little apologists, okay? Little apologetics, okay? That's what I want us to do. I want us to be people who are able to give a defense for the faith. Now, where do I get that from? Well, look with me. Actually, you can just look up here. 1 Peter 3:15. Here's what it says. But in your hearts, honor Christ, Lord, as holy, always being prepared to give a defense. That's apologia, okay? That is to give a defense, okay? That's where we get apologetic from. That's kind of the Greek word there. It says, to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with what? Gentleness and respect. So what does Peter here say? He says, look, here's the deal. You need to at all times be able to what? Give a defense. A defense of what? The hope that is in you. To give a defense for the gospel. That thing you believe about Jesus, salvation, you need to be able at any time when a conversation comes up, when a question is posed, here's what you need to be able to do. To give a defense. To give an intelligent remark about the gospel and to hopefully point people towards Christ. Now, we're going to see Jesus. He's going to do this very well in this text. And here's what we're going to see him do. And this is what we're going to hopefully be able to do at the end of this. Okay? Because we want to be people who are able to give a defense, to give an answer for the faith. Now, here's what Jesus does so well. He first listens. Now, that's kind of important. Because have you ever noticed when somebody has a question or a critique about Christianity or about the gospel or about God, we sometimes tend to not listen, right? We just get really mad and we just start going off and we start yelling and we get defensive or we walk away, we ignore them, we turn off the television. We don't want to hear a critique because we think it's dangerous. Maybe they're right. But you're going to see what Jesus does. He listens. He takes it in. And then what does Jesus do secondly? He gives an answer. Hard question, he's going to give an answer. He's going to have a very good answer for these questions. That's where we've got to be able to think and be able to articulate what we believe about the gospel so that when a hard question comes, we know how to respond to it. So we give an answer, but then what we're going to see Jesus do lastly is he's going to provoke a response in the person who's asking the question. So somebody's going to come up and try to trip Jesus up with a hard question. Jesus is going to answer the hard question, and then he's going to throw it back to them in a way where it provokes a response from them. Now, that's kind of what I want all of you to be able to do, okay? When you're in middle school, somebody throws a question or makes a comment that's against God, I want you to be able to listen. Hey, that's a good point. Let me try to answer this for you. Well, here's the truth, and then let me ask you a question. And then in that question, you actually provoke them to start thinking about who? Thinking about Christ. Because we've all got what? A worldview. Okay? And if you really understand the Christian worldview, it answers the questions because it is the truth. And what you're going to see is other worldviews that we're going to look at in a little bit, they don't really have good answers to a lot of the questions. So if you know how to reason and articulate what you believe in a question that you might have for them, you'd be surprised how much truth really does win out against things that are not true. So how does Jesus do this? We're going to look quickly at the first one, and then we're really going to kind of camp out of the second one. So this first one, you have some guys who come up to Jesus, and they're what? Spies. They don't like Jesus. They want to trip Jesus up. And they come up to Jesus, and what's their question? Hey, should we pay taxes to Caesar, right? That's their question. Hey, do you think it's lawful, Jesus, to pay taxes to Caesar? Now, that's kind of a weird question for us. I mean, how many of you guys think it's lawful to pay taxes in our country? Like, we're like, yeah. How many think it's against the law not to pay taxes? right? We go to jail for those. So this isn't really a big question for us, but you've got to understand the kind of the context of what's going on here. You've got the people of God, the Jews, who are under who? Who's in control? The Romans, right? They're under bondage in the Romans. And you know what the Jews are thinking? We're the people of God. We're under him and him alone. We don't owe any allegiance to Caesar. So why should we pay him taxes? So you kind of got the people are a little angry because they've got to pay taxes. So here they come up to Jesus and say, hey, Jesus, what do you think about taxes? Do you think it's lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And I want you to know what they're trying to do is they're putting Jesus in a corner so that no matter how he answers it, he's in big trouble. Because let's just say Jesus says, no, it's not lawful to pay Caesar taxes. Stop paying Caesar taxes. What's going to happen? They're like, yes, we got him. Speed dial. Hey, Caesar, Jesus in the temple telling everybody not to pay taxes to you. Yep, he's right here. Okay, you'll be over. All right, I'll see you then. Right? I mean, that's their hook. That's what they want Jesus to say. No, stop paying taxes. Bam. Let's take him to jail. Let's crucify him, right? Because if Caesar doesn't have people give him his money, he's in big trouble, right? So that's kind of what he wants to happen. That's what these people are trying to fish out of him. But so if Jesus says, yes, it is lawful to pay taxes, then guess what? Everyone's kind of mad at him, right? Because he's in with a bunch of people who hate paying taxes, who don't want to pay taxes. And now Jesus says, look, here, you need to pay your taxes. And they're like, we don't like you anymore. We're going to find somebody else. So they know either way he answers this, he's going to be in trouble with someone. Either the crowd's going to leave or the Romans are going to come get him. So what does Jesus do? He's like, he's in a trap, right? Have you ever noticed when Jesus is in a trap, he's not really in a trap. Like, he knows what to do. They don't learn. Anytime he asks Jesus a question, it's always a softball. He always knocks it over, right? So Jesus, as he does, he says, does anybody got a coin? By the way, has anybody got a coin? Has anybody got a quarter? A quarter would be great. Has anybody got a quarter? I'll give it back, I promise. You may have a quarter. Here's what Jesus says. Does anybody have a denarii, which is their coin? So he says, okay. Well, here's the denarii. And you got to imagine, everybody's like paying attention, like, ooh, why does he have a denarii? Yeah, okay, everyone, if you have more, just keep them coming. I'm only giving back one. The rest are for me. So he says, who's that guy? Do you know who that guy is? George Washington, right? He says, who's this guy? Whose image is the coin in? They're like, well, this is a denarii now. So they're like, that's Caesar. So it's got Caesar's mugshot on. It's like, you know, got the little reef on. It's like, Caesar. You know, he's like, okay. Well, it's got Caesar's face on it. So I think you probably should give it back to Caesar. I mean, it's a pretty good, like, comeback, right? Should we pay tax or not? Well, it's got Caesar's picture on it. So, yeah, I think you should probably give it to Caesar, you know? And he notice what he says. He says, why don't you give Caesar what's Caesar's? And then, here's where you got this hook. He says, but give God what is God's. Now, why does he say that? Well, here's what Jesus does so wisely. And this is what we got to do so wisely. He takes a little question. We've actually got a slide for this, I think. He takes a little question. Okay. Can we go to the next slide? And he puts it in the context of a bigger question. And I love how he does this. Because this is all about him getting to the bigger issue of life. Here's their issue. Hey, should we pay taxes a lot? Now, is taxes a big deal? Yeah. I mean, you know, there's an election coming up. Guess what's going to happen with every presidential candidate? Guess what they're all going to talk about? Taxes, right? And I'm going to vote for everyone's lowest taxes, right? That's just what I'm saying. You know, it's not really all I'm voting for. But it does make a difference, right? Hey, this guy's not going to tax you as much. Maybe we should vote for him. This guy's going to tax you a lot. Maybe we shouldn't vote for him. So taxes are a big issue. They're a big issue in everyday life. Everyone has what? Money. Maybe you have a little bit, maybe you have a lot, but everyone's got money. It's something that we're all used to. We all buy things with money. So it is a question at the core of who we are. Man, we got money. Should we pay taxes or not? But notice what Jesus does. He takes this little question that is not eternally significant, and he puts it in a framework of a bigger question. And here's what he says, but render to God what is God's. Now notice the thing, what he said about the analogy. He said, whose image is stamped on this coin? And what do we all say? Well, George is here, but Caesar was the answer, right? Now, do you get kind of the logic here? So your money's stamped with Caesar's image, who are you stamped with? Whose image do you bear? What have y'all been learning in Genesis chapter 1? Whose image do you bear? God's. So you see how he takes this little question. Hey, here's money. Who cares? You know, it's a quarter. No big deal. Go buy it. Here you go, Joseph. Go buy a gumball with it. You know, it's like not that big of a deal. Oh, that was meant to do that for a little humor effect. So sorry about that. You know, it's not that big of a deal. Here, go pay taxes. But notice what he does. He says, look, you're worried about what you do with your money. Here's what I'm worried about. What you do with your whole self. How about this? How about you commit your whole life to who? To God. You see, that's what really matters. You see, here Jesus, he takes a little question, he puts it in the framework of a bigger question. You're worried about money? Here's what you need to be worried about. Your whole self. You need to give everything you have to God, which includes what? Your money is part of it, right? So this is not like pay taxes and don't tithe. That's not Jesus' point. His point is, man, your whole life belongs to God. So he takes this little question and he puts it in the framework of a bigger question. That's what we've got to do as little apologists. We've got to take little questions that our friends are asking and that people are asking. Hey, what should we do about this? And then you bring it into a bigger framework of, well, how does that relate to God? So you take a little question, you turn it into a big question. I'll show you how Jesus does it again with the Sadducees. Here's what he says in verse 27. Everybody got your Bibles? Go back down to verse 27. Here's what he says. There came to him some Sadducees. Now notice this. Those who denied there is a resurrection. Here Luke is telling you, here's their worldview. They don't believe in a resurrection. Okay, that's important. And they ask him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies having a wife but no children, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife and died without children, and the second and the third took her, and likewise all seven left no children and died. Afterwards, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will this woman be? For the seven all had her as a wife. And Jesus said to them, The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy to obtain to the age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot die anymore, because they are equal to angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. But that the dead are raised, even Moses shows in the passage about the bush, where he calls the Lord God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Now he is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, for all live to him. And some of the scribes answered, Teacher, you have spoken well, for they no longer dared to ask him any question. So here we have the Sadducees come up to Jesus. Again, they ask him another very hard question, right? And here's the question. Now, in the book of Leviticus, they would have certain rules and laws that would protect the family heritage. So if you had a wife, you had no kids, and you died, then your brother would have an obligation to marry her to produce offspring for your namesake. Names were huge back then. Family lines were huge back then. So for your name to carry on, you needed to have, your brother needed to marry your wife to have children that would carry on your lineage from your wife. Okay, this was a big deal. So here's the question. They say, well, look, let's just say, and you got to know, this is a very intelligent question. These guys have been thinking about this for years. They've got the perfect question formulated that disproves the resurrection. Okay, and this is what philosophers do. They sit around and they think about questions that will prove God doesn't exist, that will prove there is no afterlife. This is what they do. So here's these Sadducees. They've came up with this awesome question. You know, kind of like the question, I remember we were in philosophy, the question came up, well, can God create a rock big enough that even he can't pick up? See, that's a hard question, right? Because it's like, well, if God can create a rock that even he can't pick up, then he's not all powerful because he can't pick up the rock. Rock wins. But if God can't create the rock, then he can't do something, which means he's not God. So, there is no God. Boom, take that. Like, that's what people do, right? They get these questions that seem to have no holes, and they'll just throw it out. Hey, Christian, hey, you're in college now. Buckle your seatbelt. I got a question for you. And you're like, yay, yay, no. Maybe God's not real. I'm sorry. Right? And this is one of those questions. They're like, ha, gotcha. What are you going to do about this, huh? He says, when they get to heaven, whose wife is she? They all had her, seven of them. Boom, had no kids. So what's up? There is no resurrection. Told you. Ha. And here's Jesus. He's like, sit down for a second. Let me explain something to you. You don't know anything about anything. Let me tell you. Let me take you to school for a minute. So, and notice what Jesus does. He takes this little question and he brings into a bigger framework. And he basically says, well, what is marriage? Let's think about marriage for a minute. Because here they're like, they're locked sealed with this question, right? Okay, we've got this question about marriage. It proves there is no resurrection. He said, well, let's hold up. Let's talk about marriage for just a minute. What exactly is marriage? And just a little side note, that's a great question for us. What is marriage? You see, I remember I was reading an article, and our president, President Obama, he was sitting around his house having a conversation with his girls. And his girls brought up the point that, you know, we've got friends who we have, you know, they have parents that are of the same sex. You know, they're living together. And, you know, it's really kind of mean that we treat them differently. That why don't we let them get married? Why can't same-sex couples get married? Why is that something that we do? It seems like that's being mean. And of course, Obama said, you know what? When I talk to my girls, it does make sense that we shouldn't treat them differently. So why not allow homosexuals to get married? I mean, why not allow that? That seems like a good thing. But that's coming from our president of the United States who says, yeah. And you see, here's what happened. He's thinking in a certain worldview that is dismissing God. There's never a question about what is marriage. It's just, well, hey, everyone should be happy, and mankind is the supreme being in the universe, and whatever makes you happy, that's what should be. So if you want to get married, fine. However you want to do it, that's okay. But the question should have been asked in the household is this. Well, hey, what is marriage? Let's have a conversation about marriage for the first part. So here's Jesus. He's talking to these Sadducees. Hold on, let's just pause for a second and ask, what is marriage? So he takes a little question, he puts in the framework of a bigger question. What is marriage? Which is a good question. So let's talk about what is marriage for just a minute. Well, here's what I'm reading a Piper book about marriage. And he said it is the doing of God for the display of God. That's what marriage is. So here's the first thing you need to know about marriage. It is God's doing. God did marriage. We didn't. We didn't show up and be like, hey, you know what would be cool? If we like got married. And let's talk about what marriage is. Well, how about a guy and a girl get married and then we'll commit to this life? Yeah, that sounds like a good thing to do. No, we did not come up with this. God did. And it's not only God's doing, it's for God's display. You see, marriage is a huge thing for a huge purpose. Here's what marriage does. It displays the glory of God. And primarily the way it does it is it displays it through the husband and wife relationship, because the husband represents Christ and the wife represents the church. So when husband and wife come together in marriage, they are displaying an amazing glory, the glory of Christ in the church. So that's what marriage is. And let's go back to the Obama household. Well, it's not just something you just give out and say, oh, well, this is cool if we like it like this way. No, there's guidelines because it's God's doing for God's glory, so we can't tamper with it because it doesn't work outside of the context God has created it for. So it would have been great if the president would just say, hey, well, girls, let's think about what is marriage. But instead, they didn't ask the big question. They just asked the little question. Well, hey, what's going to make everyone happy? Well, let's just do this. You've got to step back and ask the bigger question. How does this relate to God? What does God say about this? So here we are in the text. So Jesus says, well, here's something that you've misunderstood. You've misunderstood marriage. And he says, here's what marriage is. And here's what some of you might not know. Marriage is a temporary reality that is pointing towards an eternal state. Marriage is a temporary reality. Marriage does not last throughout eternity. I am married to Katie for X amount of years till one of us die. She's stuck with me, okay? So I'm there, she's there until we die. But Jesus says, look, that's this age. And the whole point of them being married is to point to something greater. There's an age to come where Jesus will be married to his bride. And we will be eternally with Jesus celebrating this crazy relationship that we can't even grasp that is 1,000 times better than my relationship with Katie. And my relationship with Katie is great. So, but it's 1,000 times better. It's huge. Here's what he says. Here's what you don't understand. See, marriage is temporary for now, but in the age to come, in the resurrection, there is no marriage. Me and Katie will not be married. We won't. And I'm like, oh, that's so sad. It is kind of like, man, but I want to be married to Katie. But there is no marriage. There's no giving of marriage. There's no hands in marriage. There is no married couples. But we'll be like the angels, right? We'll be eternal. We're not gonna die anymore. We're gonna live forever. And we're not gonna give in marriage. Why? Because marriage is temporary that points to an eternal reality. So here's what Jesus says. Well, here's the problem with your question. You have a fundamental mistake. You don't understand what marriage is. So let me tell you what marriage is. So notice, what does Jesus do? He listens, and then he does what? He answers, and then he provokes a response. And he says, oh yeah, that other part about Moses and the whole thing about the law proves there is no resurrection. Do you remember the passage about the bush? Love that line. I mean, that's what Jesus said. Hey, do you remember the passage about the bush? That's just funny. Does everybody know what the bush is? What's he talking about? The burning bush. Isn't that funny, though, that he said the passage about the bush? I just think that's funny. Of course, they didn't have like chapters and verses back then. So it's like, hey, do you remember that story about the bush caught on fire? Do you remember what God said when he showed up? I am God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says, do you think God is a God of dead people? And they're like, I don't think so. That'd be kind of weird. He says, no, God is a God of who? The living. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are they dead right now? No, they're alive. How are they alive? Because there is a resurrection. See, there's a resurrection. See, he takes this complicated question that they've got so tight in their airlock. They're like, proves it. No resurrection. Just like, well, here's the deal. You misunderstood the whole question. You don't understand marriage. You don't understand reality. So let me show you the truth. And he just unpacks it and he reveals it to them. And then so they're like, oh yeah. And what's really funny, what I really think is cool is the scribes. They're like, yeah, Jesus, that's right. And they're like, hey, Sadducees, we told you there's a resurrection. What's up? Like, see, Jesus, he's awesome. And then it's funny because at the end of the passage we're going to read, Jesus rebukes the scribes. I just think it's funny. They're like, yeah, Jesus. And he's like, okay, beware of the scribes because they're all false and they wear long robes and they all pray bad. And just beware of them. They're like, oh, we thought we were right. Man. But you've got to have this moment where, like, the scribes are all excited because they're like, yes, we agree. Jesus is the truth. There is a resurrection. So we see Jesus. He listens. He gives an answer. And then he does what? He provokes them to think. Hey, here's the truth. Jesus is the God of alive people. So there is a resurrection. So there's implications for your life, right? There's a big deal for your life on how this is going to all play out. And then Jesus, so he's been asked these tough questions. They're all coming from various worldviews. They believe certain things. They're trying to trick him. And Jesus reveals, hey, what you think you know, you don't really know. So let me try to share some truth with you so you can see the world truly. And then Jesus then asked them a question. And this is what I think we need to do more when we're meeting with unbelievers. Instead of just getting all the hard questions, we need to be giving questions. Because they've got a whole lot of questions to answer. And a lot of the different worldviews, they don't have good answers for a lot of the questions. So you just dialogue. Just ask questions. And here's what we're going to see Jesus do. And then we're going to talk about maybe some questions that we could ask as we think about being little people who love apologetics. Here's what it says in verse 41. Everybody got it? 41. But he said to them, how can they say that the Christ is David's son? So here's Jesus' question. How can you say that the Christ, the Messiah, is only human? He's just David's son. That's the question. How do you claim the Messiah is only human? Okay? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, which we just read, the Lord said to my Lord, set at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. David thus calls him Lord. So how is he his son? And then I'll just finish it out. In the hearing of all the people, he said to the disciples, beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplace and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at the feast, who devour widows' houses and for pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. So remember, the scribes, they're still high-fiving. Yeah, Jesus got the Sadducees. Hey, beware of these guys. They're trouble. Oh, man, we don't like Jesus again. But here's Jesus' question to them, and it's a good question. Let me ask you this question. How do you assume the Messiah is only human when, how do you get that he's just David's son and that's it, when David said to him, Lord, you are my Lord? So David called him Lord, called him Adonai, called him God. You are my Lord. You are my God. He's speaking. I mean, can you imagine if, like, I went up to Kreider? I'm like, hey, Kreider, you're my son, but you are my God. That'd be weird, right? Like, if you were there, you'd be like, okay, we're moving churches now. I mean, that's just weird. But here's David. He's looking forward at the Messiah. It's a prophecy about the Messiah. It's all about the Messiah. He says, look, you're my Lord. So they throw this question to the religious leaders. Hey, you study the law, you know about the Messiah, you know about the prophecy. So how can he be only a man if he's also God in this passage? How do we reconcile that? So he's just giving them a question. He's provoking them to what? To think about who he is and who is Jesus. How can the Messiah be fully man and also be God? How can these two things be reconciled? Do we have an answer for that? We do, right? It's in the man Jesus Christ, who is the God-man, where God took on the form of a human, was born of a virgin, taking on full humanity. And as full God and full man, he is now walking on earth as Jesus Christ. So he is throwing them a question to get them to think about, who am I? Who is the Messiah? Who is Jesus? Because he is not just a human being, though he is, but he is also fully God. So here Jesus, he answers tough questions. And he, how does he do it? He listens, he answers, and he provokes. You got the last one. Good. You're like, oh, I get it. These are the three. Yeah, this is what he does. And he also takes little questions and he puts them in the context of what? Bigger questions. He takes something that your friend would ask you and he says, well, how does this relate to God? What is, you know, hey, why are Christians against gay marriage? Well, what is marriage? Little question, bigger question now. What's marriage? Well, let's define that. Well, it's God's doing for God's glory. And it's about Christ and the church. And there's roles, husband and wife. And this is all picturing Christ and his church. So now, that's why we can't go there. It's not because we don't want everybody to be happy. We know that happiness is following the will of God. And we know that there's meaning to these different things. See, we have to take little questions and we have to put them in the bigger framework. I mean, you're going to get questions all the time. Man, if God is so loving, why is my mom suffering from a disease? Why is that? And that's a real question that we have to address. And we can't just say, well, I don't know. He is, but I just know we give him an answer. But we take a little question and we put in a bigger framework. Well, here's the deal. God is loving. God is good. But here's the problem. We have sinned. And our sin brings all kinds of damage to planet. It brings sickness. It brings disease. It brings all kinds of havoc. But you know what? God stepped down in our disease-cursed world. And he took the disease of sin on himself and bled on a cross. So yes, bad things happen, but God is still good. You know why? Because, man, sin affects everything, but God, in the midst of sin, steps into a sin-cursed world to fix it and reverse it and to give hope, even when it seems like there is no hope. So I want to encourage you guys to think about questions you're being ask and try to put them in a bigger framework. And don't be afraid to actually ask questions to people. You know, this is what some of the ones I hear all the time. You know, Christianity is just the worst. Just all the world perils are blamed on Christianity. They've made all the wars. They just made society a terrible place. How many of you guys have heard that? Well, you will. Don't worry. And you know what a good question to ask? Well, you know, if Christians are so bad, why does every hospital you go to, why does it have something about religion? Why is it like Baptist this or Methodist this or Catholic? Have you ever noticed that? Every hospital you go to is going to have Christ somewhere in it. So all the Christians are bad, but they're the ones building all the hospitals. Does it seem like maybe there's a misconception on Christianity? Oh, maybe we're not that evil. Maybe we care more than everyone else. Maybe we love people like crazy. You see, I want to encourage you to listen, answer, and then provoke. Because you're going to be surprised that when you know the truth, man, God can take the truth and do some absolutely amazing things. I'll just give you a little example of me. When I went to college, I became a new believer in college. So I was brand new to everything, which means I was just like gung-ho, like wide open, reading everything I could, listening to every sermon under the sun. I was just like that guy that was like, yeah, if I met you, I'm like, hey, my name's Corey. Do you know Jesus? Let me tell you about it. Woo! Like, I was just pumped, right? So I go into a philosophy class in Murray State. Now, here's kind of worldview thinking, okay? Here's my professor who had a naturalistic worldview. And here's what that meant. He was heavily committed to Darwinian evolution, which says there is no God. We all came from the Big Bang and then a single organism from way back when in millions of years. Now everything is like it is now. He's very committed to that. So everything about the world, he interprets through that framework. That's his worldview. And his mission in life, I think, was to convince all the little Christians who grew up in Western Kentucky how ridiculous it was to be a Christian. I mean, that was his mission. So I'm here in this class, new believer, haven't been a believer long, but, you know, I've been in church for a while. So first day of class, he just starts going after the Bible. His whole mission in the first class is to prove the Bible is not true. And I'm just dumb enough to think, hey, I know more than this guy about the Bible, right? So I just jump in. And so he starts out and he begins to say, look, did you know that there are actually two creation accounts in Genesis? Do you guys know that? There's two creation accounts. God actually created the world in Genesis 1. And then in Genesis 2, he creates whole new people. I bet you never heard that before. There's two creation accounts. You would be surprised at how much in the Bible is just crazy. It's just not. It's just myth. It doesn't make logical sense. So I raise my hand. And he's like, oh, somebody raised their hand. And, you know, I raise my hand. And I said, do you know Hebrew? And it kind of caught him off guard, right? And which I didn't know Hebrew either, but I just asked him. Do you know Hebrew? Because I'd studied this a little bit. He said, no, wasn't going to do anything. Well, I said, you know the Bible is written in Hebrew, right? Wasn't going to do anything. Well, I think a lot, for one. If you don't know Hebrew, you might be surprised at what it says. And I said, well, here's the deal. That's what's called a Hebraism. What that means is, in Hebrew writing, here's what they did. They would state something in kind of an overview fashion, and then they would go back right after that and they would fill in all the details by restating it. So, professor, actually, there's not two creation accounts. If you read it carefully, it's the same creation account. He just says, big general deal, created man in my image. Now, here's the details. I created the man first. I created the woman second. He did that for a reason. It was for marriage. It was to show the picture of Christ. And I went through all that. He's like, well, the Bible's false and it's just myth. You know, he just goes into the rant. And it was amazing all through that semester. And I was not the brightest kid in the classroom, I promise you. But I was just speaking up and I would just tell truth. And it's amazing what truth does when it's compared to falsehood. So I'll never forget, halfway through the semester, we get ready to study evolution in the philosophy class. So he's doing evolution versus creationism. He says, okay, Corey, you're doing creationism. Okay, thanks, professor. Just picks me at random. And he says, all right, who wants to do evolution? And this girl raised her hand, and she was a biology major. Okay, so you got me, new Christian, knows nothing hardly about biology or science or anything. I'm the guy who gets picked to do the presentation on creationism, and she, the biology major, gets to do evolution. So it's kind of a setup deal, right? It's like, okay, little Baptist boy is going to go down in gunfire. It's fun. This is awesome. Like, he's excited, right? And so I decided, well, I'll go meet with Jimmy Slack. If you don't know Jimmy Slack, he's brilliant. So Jimmy Slack, we met down. He said, look, here's what's probably going to happen. She's probably going to bring up this, and there's a lot of holes in this. It doesn't make good sense logically, so you need to say this, this, and this. And she's going to bring up this, and I'm telling you, there's no data to support. You need to bring up this. And she's going to go with this thing, and I'm just telling you, it's a very weak argument, and if you bring up this, you will not know what to say. So I have all this stuff, and we go into class, and of course, professor's like, this is going to be awesome. Like, little Baptist boy's going down. Creationism is absolutely false. So we get up. I kid you not. She walks up. She gives her present. I'm looking at my notes like, it's word for word. That's what she, okay. And I get up, and I show, notice she brought up this, but she has no explanation for this, this, and this. And I really wish I had more time. I'd go in. It's really good. But then it's all his notes, not mine. And then she brought up another argument. And I showed, well, here's the holes in it. Here's why this doesn't match up. And through that class, I showed, just using science, that without a doubt, God created the universe. And we took a vote after class. And guess what? Unanimous. Creationism won. Unanimous. I'm like, that's awesome. And my professor was just literally red-faced. I mean, he was just so angry. And the last little illustration I'll give really quickly, it's the last end of the semester, he had the idea that he was going to convince everyone that there was no immaterial soul. We don't have a soul. Nothing is after we die. We just cease to exist. There's no soul. Okay? So he brings in a Star Trek movie. I'm not even making this up. And we watch Star Trek, the whole hour episode. And it's where Captain Picard gets transported to another planet, something misfires, and two of him are now cloned, and they're both alive, they're both walking around, they both have personalities. We watch this. Fresh gets up. Told you. If we have immaterial souls, how do you explain both of them being alive? I'm not making this up. I am not PhD, okay, professor. You just can't make this up. And I just said, Star Trek. That was my only comment. I mean, it was like, really? Like, this is the best you have against my worldview that God created the world and he is sovereign. He is over everything. You've got Star Trek? That's your line? But here's what I want to just convey to you guys. Notice what Jesus did here. He gets tough questions, he listens, he answers, and he provokes. He asks a question to get them to think. And I want you to try to think through, what are the questions your friends are asking? What are the questions our culture is asking? And here's what you're going to see. They're questions that come out of a worldview. So you need to identify, okay, what's the worldview this has come out of? And how can I take the little question and do what with it? Put it in the context of the bigger question. Okay, here's what you're talking about. Now let's bring this in the full view. How does this relate to God? And then you provoke them to start thinking. And here's what I want to encourage you. If you have a correct worldview, and notice, this is why we're doing the pursuit, so that you understand the Bible, so that you start thinking through a biblical worldview, because even your worldview is probably off in some things. So we're reading through the Bible so you can know this is the correct worldview. And when you have the right worldview, you'll be surprised. When you stand up for truth and when you speak and ask good questions to listen and provoke, guess what's going to happen? There's going to be some responses. Some people are going to come to Christ because their worldview is going to come tumbling down. And through that, maybe get to lead them to the Lord. You know, I started that class with an enemy. As that professor, that's what he thought about me. You know what, at the end of the class, we were talking, we were having good conversation, we'd stay after class, he had questions about the Bible, questions about the gospel. He was actually kind of thinking a little bit through, maybe I don't have it all together. I don't know if he's a Christian today, I still pray for him every once in a while, but I promise you, if you will just speak and answer and listen and provoke, You'll be surprised what God can do because his word is powerful and you have the truth. And we're living in a culture that is slowly eroding from the truth. Let's be little apologetics. Let's be people that speak the truth in love. I'm going to pray. The band's going to come lead a couple more songs, and then we're going to transition into small groups. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the example of Jesus who loved people. So he took questions and he didn't ignore them, but he thought through them and he answered them. And in his answers, he always provoked a response from them. God, I pray that we would do the same. God, we have all kinds of questions that our culture is asking us. Is there truth? Is there morality? Is stem cell research okay? All these different questions all have to be worded in the context of a worldview. So help us be people who know what we believe and we can tell someone else what we believe so that it puts holes in their worldview so that they all of a sudden don't, they realize they don't have it all together and maybe they need something more and the person they need is Christ. So God, help us to leave this place listening, answering, and provoking for your honor and your glory. We pray this in the good name of Jesus. Amen.